I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to Sick Boy, a podcast where we talk about what it's like to be sick. This week's guest is Ami Nattu. She had endometrial cancer and is the co-host of Call Your Girlfriend podcast. Let's talk about it.
It's just fine.
Yeah, this is actually very true.
And a wonderful way to kick things off.
I wish I had rhythm, you guys.
Some of us are on the ones and the threes, and some of us are on the twos and the fours. You know, I'm like, it's fine, it's fine. People are different.
Fuck.
Brian's on a two and a half, I think.
What a way to kick this off. Ami Nattu, I'm excited to kind of dive deep into your story. I guess for a little bit of context, You are no stranger to frank and intimate conversations. You are the co-host of Call Your Girlfriend podcast, which you co-created and co-host with your friend Anne. Let's get that out of the way first, so we can get an idea of what Call Your Girlfriend podcast is all about, and then I think we're gonna get into the nitty gritty about your own personal life.
Oh my God, this is my first Canadian podcast, I think, and I'm dying about the about. Thank you. So let's just get that out of the way.
We're going to profusely apologize as well.
Is that a real stereotype? My brother lives in Montreal, and my only experience of Canada is like French Canada because, you know, we're like semi-European, so it's funny. But nice to meet all of you. Call Your Girlfriend is a podcast that is hosted. I'm going to let that ambulance go by. First, sorry, we are still in the ambulance noise of our pandemic.
I'm loving the background sounds of Brooklyn, New York. It's the ambiance is beautiful.
Absolutely,
yeah. We're in a pandemic. We don't know how the rest of the world is doing. It's rough over here. Call Your Girlfriend is a podcast that is hosted by me and my friend Anne Friedman, and that is produced by our friend Gina Delvac. It is a true labor of love. Ooh. A show that we have done for 6 years now.
Wow, kudos!
So wild. Ooh. 6 years ago, started a podcast, and it really is at the heart a conversation between Anne and I, two friends who are long distance and catch up on everything from the news to politics to pop culture to, you know, how we're feeling in our bodies and how we are managing our money and how, you know, like everything is a scam under the sun. So it really is about truly us and the things we care about.
So is it as simple as saying, you know, the things that you would have conversations about with your best friend on a podcast?
100%. You know, Anne and I are two friends who we have lived far apart longer than we have lived in the same city at this point. And we're both like very nerdy about, you know, processes for keeping in touch. And so at the beginning of our long distance friendship, we would literally send out an agenda that was like, okay, here are all the things I need to discuss with you. And if we don't write it down, we are never going to get through this phone call. And, you know, and sometimes they are really personal, private things like the people you're dating or the really mundane stuff about your life. And then other times it was like, oh, I really want to talk to you about this insane politician or this weird thing that's happening in online feminism. And so we have retained all of the... the things that are not super personal are not the things that we talk about on the show. But we think that that is a fair experience of how most people are with their long distance friends. You got to make time to talk about the stuff that you
care
about.
It's funny you say that because my wife and I have been, we've been long distance together a lot throughout our, our like 10-year marriage. And we also host a podcast together. And I haven't actually like, I haven't really seen my wife in like, I mean, really, it's been like almost 6 months since I've spent any like real time face to face with her. And the like, I feel like a podcast is something that all friendships or all relationships could really use, especially in this weird time that we're currently in, where we're spending so much time apart. But it really is a wonderful tool to like, and we talk about this too on Sick Boy a lot, you know, in terms of how do you have those, how do you have those tough conversations with family members or friends who are sick, who are dealing with cancer, who are dealing with, you know, whatever their illness is, how do you have those conversations? And like, that's a question that we always get asked. And the thing that the answer is like, well, you gotta make the time for that. And that's one of the beautiful things about having a podcast with like a partner or your best friends is you just schedule the time to actively get together and have a conversation and talk about the things that you like need to get off your back or that you just want to delve into with that particular person. And
but it also goes to show how like important that is to do if you don't have a podcast either.
Yeah,
right?
exactly, my point.
Right. Know? Not every friendship is going to host a podcast together. And I really hope that is not the takeaway here.
Everybody start one. Schedule.
Yeah, but I think that you are really right about spending some structured time with your friends and your community to talk about the things that you care about. And, you know, I am really lucky that I get to host a show with someone who is my best friend, is someone that I, you know, just like trust and love so much. I wish that I could have that kind of time investment in all of my relationships. It's not possible. But I do think that the takeaway there is that you have to make time to talk about the things that you care about. Otherwise, life just happens.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Having said that then, and being a podcast host yourself, I know that, you know, a big part of what we're going to talk about today is your experience with cancer. And I guess, well, yeah, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but how much has that experience played a role in what you're delving into in your podcast? You know, or are you trying to keep your experience with cancer separate from the conversations that you guys have set out to have on your particular show, on your particular platform?
That's a really interesting question. I think that, you know, cancer is part of my story. It's not the entirety of who I am. I think that for me, at least, it's fair to say that there are things in my life that have been harder than the cancer I've had. And so it's not this, it's not a life defining moment. It just really is a like, oh yeah, life is hard.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to have to just deal with that. And I think that on the podcast itself, you know, I was dealing in the background of my show with dealing with getting, with being sick for many, many years and then finally being diagnosed with cancer. And it was not something that was always at the foreground of the conversation, but it was something that was always happening in the back and was super aware of it. I think that that's normal because our show is not, you know, it's not really a show where we talk about ourselves. Mm. And so I think that if you are paying really close attention, you know, you have a lot of biographical details about us, you know, where we went to school, you know, like the soda we like, or, you know, like whatever, you know, some stuff about us because we're friends who talk about that stuff. But it is really an edited conversation about topics that we think are important, and it is very editorialized. And so we did, you know, I ended up disclosing on the show that I had cancer because at that point it felt important to tell everyone, also because I was going to be taking a break from it. You know, I ended up doing a reported series around like kind of pelvic disorders and kind of the warning signs for that. And I have talked about the experience of having cancer, but it is not, it's not a show about, you know, like Anne Friedman and her friend with cancer.
Well, let's do the Jeremy, Brian and Taylor and their friend with cancer podcast then. And and fucking dive deep into, so what kind of cancer did you have? You kind of just like sort of scratched the surface there, but it was pelvic related cancer.
Yeah, so I had endometrial cancer, which is a cancer of the uterus. It is one of the gynecological cancers. And gynecological cancers are really there's nothing special about them. There's a lot of them. They're abundant and out there and no one talks about them. And so I did not understand just how I didn't have a rare condition. So many women have gynecological cancers. And it, you know, for me, it was really interesting because my entire life, since I have been a menstruating person, so since I was 11 years old, I have had issues with my menstruation. Like, my period is always too heavy. It was never regular. It was just never, it was not a great experience. But I just really was conditioned growing up in a way that I thought that all women were experiencing the same kind of pain that I was.
Right.
So, you know, I was like, okay, great. Being a woman is playing through the pain. I did sports in high school and never complained once. Had full-time jobs and never really took days off because, you know, guess what? Like, being a lady is just being in pain all
right.
the time. No one told me. And, and I think that it's – now I am not surprised by any of that because I do think that there is such a reticence to talk about one's, you know, like, menstruation and, like, all of – like, everything that happens in the vagina area is, those are still, like, very taboo conversations. But I really wonder what my life would have been like if – I had grown up in a family and in a society where, you know, as a 12-year-old, I was like, okay, this is really painful, and maybe I shouldn't live with this pain.
Yeah.
And so fast forward to, you know, being like 33 and not really understanding so much of my body and getting this diagnosis that did not come out of nowhere. I had been like really dealing with a lot of chronic illness, I would say, in the last like 5 years before I got diagnosed in this very real way. And so for me, a cancer diagnosis was in a way kind of a relief because it just felt like a diagnosis feels actionable.
Yeah.
You know,
I
think that if you have chronic conditions where doctors are like, we don't really know what to do. Like, sure, like, you're in pain. Here's, like, more Tylenol or here's more birth control or whatever. There is just, like, there is a kind of paranoia and really just, like, depression that sets in about knowing that you are constantly in pain and there's nothing.
There's, like, almost a security in a label. You know, it's like you get some sort of at least relief that you go, okay, like you just said, actionable. Like, we know this is a thing.
Right.
And I know that through everything that I've seen, whether through the media or through, you know, talking to other people, there's like a route we can take to try to take care of this one thing that you have just now labeled upon me.
And if you know what it is, you feel like, okay, well, even if it's not curable per se, there might be there's a therapy or there's these things that we can do that we know we can help you.
There are
feel
just
more
steps to take. There are steps to take.
Yeah.
There are steps to take. There's, you know, there are like appointments you can go to. There's a whole way that you can, your mind and your time can be occupied by having a diagnosis, even if it's not a good diagnosis.
Yeah.
That is not true when you just don't know what you're sick with.
Yeah.
In terms of the chronic illness, like leading up to that, you said like for the 5 years before that, you were experiencing all of these other things as well. Were they all tied into that diagnosis, or are they just, is there just kind of a smorgasbord of things going on there?
Yeah,
it's a big word,
you know,
Brian.
It is a smorgasbord of things going on there where some of the things, and this is what is so, I think has been like so hard for me to even wrap my mind around with having cancer, is that the symptoms for endometrial cancer are like, maybe you're bleeding too much, your back hurts, and, you have cramps. That's literally every woman with a period. It's a vague rubric of symptoms.
Yeah.
And also like not something that is really diagnosed in younger people. Mostly it is mostly like women who are menopausal it is menstruating people who are menopausal who mostly will be diagnosed with this because once you are in menopause, you're not supposed to have your period. So once you're bleeding, it's like 911, what's going on here?
Right.
Those people tend to be older. But for me, it's like I had the back pain. I'd had that for years. I had had, you know, like the awful bleeding for years, but also I was experiencing these headaches. I had to have all these blood transfusions. I was every symptom that people with, you know, all sorts of undiagnosed, like, gynecological issues have, was something that I had been experiencing. Like, I was never diagnosed with PCOS. I now understand that I had PCOS, but no one ever diagnosed me with that. Like, at one of my oncology checkups, the oncologist brought it up, and she was like, how long did you have PCOS before you start, you know, like, you started seeing me? I'm like, ma'am, no one has ever told me I have PCOS, so that is wild.
PCOS is polycystic ovary... Ovarian syndrome. Yeah.
Ovarian syndrome. Good job. Good job. Yeah. But it's like, like another really common condition that people with uteruses will have. And it's just really fascinating to me that, you know, there is just an expectation that for women, your body really is all about reproduction. Mm. And so my entire young life and adult life, when I would go to the gynecologist, which was often, you know, it was always like, oh yeah, like, you can have a baby anytime you want. I'm like, I would love to maybe have a baby one day, but mostly I just want to have a normal life today. Can you make that happen for me?
Right,
Can I play tennis and not, like, you know, like, drop a bucket of blood on the tennis court? That would be nice. And so,
did that happen? So, is that a
no, that did not happen. But when I was playing basketball in middle school, I will never forget, like body blocking this, like, a terrible girl, grabbing the ball from her, and I was like, I am about to make the shot of my eighth grade career. Yeah. Like, this is it. Yeah. This is it. And just feeling this, like, ginormous amount of blood just, like, pour down from my uterus into my underwear. And it is a defining, I was like, yeah, my basketball career is over. Like, I don't think I will ever go for a shot again. But yeah, you know, it really sucks. It really sucks. There are, menstruating is something that, when it does not work well for you, is really limits your ability to live a full and good life. Mm-hmm. And so many people around the world have to deal with it, and yet it's still a super taboo topic.
Yeah.
Well, when we really just started rolling into the conversation, and you were talking about, like, there are some, and this is a bit of a Pandora's box, but we come up with these narratives, and, like, the taboo nature of these subjects starts from, like, a really early age, and in the way that maybe it's our parents, how our parents talk about it, the community at large talks about certain issues, the way that we're educated about things, you know, like, how we treat, you know, going through puberty, and at least in my experience, was largely like, hit play on this, you know, informational video and, you know, see, you know, penises and
flying penises
and vaginas and like falling from the sky. And it's like, changes are falling. And it's like, try to explain.
Wait,
and then it's like,
whoa.
That's a real video.
Yeah. You guys both watch that?
Yeah, that's a real video.
Exactly what you're
Is
talking
that what
about.
They're doing in Canada? There's just penises and vaginas falling in a video?
In, like, an animated video. Yeah, with, like, wings. Yes.
Angel wings and
angel
shit.
Wings.
And I am screaming.
That's fucking crazy.
And that's just like, and then that is a... And then, like, with a little bit of, like, and, like, remember, you have to wear a condom, sort of
sprinkled,
you know, thrown in there by the teacher afterwards. And it's like, we don't want to, and so that's where we get that information a lot. You know, if we're lucky to have parents that really dig into it and aren't shy about it, then that's a bonus. But, you know, most people are coming up with, like, a built-in nature of shying away from really being open about, like, you know, the pain that you might feel in when you have your period, or like you, Jer, and other people we've talked to on the show with Phimosis, like, where it's like, where you're like, hey, my
dick is different.
Hurts massively when I try to, like, masturbate or have sex. And it's like the embarrassment that might come around that and all that stuff. It's like, That's just like built in and sets us up for this maybe shying away from seeking out help because whether we're taught to toughen
not just,
up or
but not just
it is.
Seeking out the help, Tay. It's like, it's also the, you know, it's like we're at least I've been learning this over the last, you know, last, like, couple of years, especially with, like shows like Explained coming out and talking about, you know, women's reproductive health. It's like, it's not just people feeling like they can't go get the help. It's also the lack of funding for like the science to go into actually explaining what the fuck is going on in the female body.
Yeah.
It's like,
especially on the female side.
Medicine does not care about women's bodies. Like, the, if you want to open that can of worms of most of the drugs that we use are tested on men. Most of the protocols that we use are all geared towards how that works. And even just the way that we're speaking in this like male female binary, frankly, is not great, because not everyone fits into the binary of gender.
Right.
And but you know what you're saying, Taylor, is really resonating with me. Like, I grew up in a fairly conservative, like, African Muslim home. I remember, you know, like, I got my period and I remember telling my mom, and I was so ashamed to tell her. Like, I don't even know what, you know, I was like, my mom was not someone who made me feel ashamed about my body, but I understood that my body was not something to be, you know, like, it's just, it's weird. And so I remember telling my mom, and I think maybe like the third or fourth period I had, my mom was actually sick in the hospital and I didn't have any pads. And so she called me and she was like, "We're going to have to tell your dad, and your dad will get this stuff for you." And I remember thinking, I was like, I would rather die than have to talk to my father about this. And I think she like called him, and at some point he like called me into his, you know, his study, and he was like, "Here is some money for things you need," you know, and he couldn't look me in the eye.
Coded language.
It was just, it's a very weird thing. And then I went to this high school where, like, that was very religious and Christian. And I remember in doing all of the sports that I did, the coach very much telling all of the girls on the sports team, like, you know, like, "We are not women who use our periods as excuses not to, you know, like, not to show up here every day and do the drills." And so there is just this like bravado also that you think you're doing, but just being like, "I'm not a complainer." Like, all these other women who like complains about PMS or whatever, they're all like lying bitches and I'm just a cool girl. And you know, and all of it is just, it's really baked into the way that we talk about things. And, you know, and then you also go through life as a young adult being that, like, I know that I have had to have like uncomfortable conversations with sexual partners, you know, about like, how are we going to treat sex when we're menstruating? Like, is that something that you're grossed out by or not? And if you are grossed out by it, then I definitely do not want to sleep with you. You know, like, it's just this. I just think that, like, if you are a man who sleeps with people who have periods, you know, you're going to have to get used to blood. Yeah. And that, it just, I mean, like, grow up. Like, body functions happen. And, but it, you know, it's all so hard to talk about because it all comes from this, like, place that we have decided is taboo, and frankly it's really stupid.
And absolutely. Then it spills over into everything else. I mean, if you're uncomfortable talking about some of the most like basic human functions, then you're probably not going to have, you know, I'm making a broad generalization, but it's probably going to affect the success that you have talking about other hard stuff that goes on in life, which is a shitload of stuff. And I know from my experience, and I think I speak for Jeremy and Bri as well, it's like doing this podcast and having these conversations where we talk to people about, you know, some really tough shit and a lot of times like lay our own shit out on the table too. I mean, definitely helps. You know, it's like, you know, maybe a super Canadian analogy coming your way, but it's like shooting with a weighted puck. You know, it feels.
I'm sorry. I'm like literally visualizing it right now. But luckily for you, I've started going to hockey games recently, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know, the regular puck feels a lot easier when you switch back.
Weighted puck.
I do want to come back though to your experience in navigating your cancer diagnosis. Like, how did you come to find out that you had endometrial cancer? Like, was this just from a regular gynecologist appointment and they were like, "Hey, well, this is weird, like we're seeing some abnormalities here," or was this through like a consistent struggle with, like you were saying, this struggle with like your menstruation and always having these constant problems?
You know, it was a real journey. I think 2 years or maybe a year and some change before I got diagnosed, everything had just started becoming really unbearable. It was like any time I had a period, I had to have a blood transfusion because I was bleeding
Holy
so much.
Holy fuck, what?
Yeah, it was like, it was wild.
A blood transfusion? Like, you know, like you were...
A blood transfusion every time, like bleeding like a gunshot victim, like just from having...
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah, me, and I'm curious to ask, like, is that something some people with who have periods? Like, is that something that some people just have to do on a regular basis?
Not on a, I would say, like, it is not normal. It's not like normal, but it is a thing that happens to people all the time. So like people who bleed a lot definitely have a lot of iron deficiencies. So you kind of have to like do that. But if you bleed so much that you are losing as much blood as I am, you have to have blood transfusions. And I was having these blood transfusions like fairly regularly. And the doctor that I was seeing at the time just kept giving me more, you know, like birth control. And they were like, let's see if this works and let's see if that works. And I had an IUD in and I was like, okay, like I'm just basically mainlining the hormones because at this point they're like, this is the best that we can do. And in the middle of that, I also like left. I was living in San Francisco and moved back to New York, which meant that I had to like start over with a new doctor. And so I go to the new doctor, and it is the first time that I actually have a black woman doctor. And I walk into her office, and I'm just a mess. You know, like I'm just, my anxiety is at an all-time high. I'm one of those people that they have to take my my pulse twice in the appointment because the first time it's just
210.
Yeah, they're just like, what's going on here? And I'm like, just give it 5 minutes, and then you know we're back to normal. And she was the first doctor that she looked at me and she said, she was like, let's talk about your anxiety. And I was like, I'm not anxious. I'm here for my period. And she was like, Amina, she's like, I just asked you to take a deep breath. Like, how much do you think you just filled your lungs up with that breath you took? And I thought she was complimenting on my like amazing swimming abilities. I was like, oh yeah. I was like, lady, I know, right? Like my lungs so full. And she was like, there is no air here. Like
you are hyperventilating.
You are so tense. Like what the fuck is happening? And I kind of talked to her and I was like, hey, I have been having this like issue for many years now and nothing is happening. Like what am I supposed to do? And it was the first time that a doctor looked at me with compassion. And I don't think that it is an accident that this doctor was black. And she was like, let's start from the very beginning. Let's run every single test and let's start from, you know, like let's start from the beginning. She sent me out for an X-ray and all these things. And, you know, like tests just take like forever to do.
Sorry to interrupt you, but it's so interesting to hear, like when you said, she said, hey, let's talk about your anxiety. I had like this visceral reaction of like goosebumps and like this feeling of like, oh, what a compassionate doctor. Mm-hmm. And then I was thinking as you were talking through that and thinking like, fuck, why did I have that reaction that they did something that they should be doing anyway? You know, like all doctors should have a level of compassion where they like identify things like that and see it and go, oh my God, like I should be more aware of this. Like maybe I should look into this. Maybe I should ask this patient some more questions about that. And I'm surprised that I had that visceral reaction to that when like it should be, status quo should be better than what it is, right?
It should be, you know, but at my most generous, I like, you know, I also get that like being a doctor is stressful and it's a business. And, you know, if they're really gonna diagnose you with everything that's going on, you know, I was like, let's really talk about the healthcare system and how we're teaching people to be doctors. But I do think that it is fair to say that for black women in the medical system in America, there is a lot of institutional racism that also just affects the way that you are treated as a patient. You know, when I go to a doctor and I say my pain is off the charts, I really do mean it because I have been enduring pain for years and not complained. Mm. You know, like I know that when I say this is bad, we are talking like 12 alarm fire at this point, right? But there are all these studies that show that like black women receive less pain medication at the hospital, their pain is taken less seriously and whatever. And I was like, that is not an individual doctor's fault. It is truly that
the system.
Medicine is also systematically racist. And if you read up actually about the history of gynecology in America, it was literally started by a man who was operating on enslaved women, you know? And so that is like a whole other thread to unspool there about, the sins of the fathers and how that just like trickles down generations later. But so in seeing my new doctor, I'm feeling some hope and we're going through all this testing. I'm doing the X-rays. Nothing is showing up. And in the middle of that, she leaves New York. Like she was leaving New York to move somewhere else. And I was devastated. And so she's like, I'm passing you off to like the new doctor in the practice who is amazing. And I trust her and she's going to continue your care. move in with the new doctor, and it's, you know, it goes back a little bit more to status quo, where she's like, let's start the workup again and see like what's going on here. And as she is running tests, I am feeling very much like I am running out of time. I was like, I cannot go back to this zero. So I order like all, like every gynecological textbook that I can get my hands on. And I was a project manager in my previous job, and I was like, I'm going to project manage my illness. Mm. And so I request all of my medical records from everywhere I've lived. My wall at home becomes like a conspiracy theory board. What is like
strings, strings and pegs, just linking everything together.
Right. And so I'm looking at the things, and you know, and at the same time, like my new doctor is awesome, and she comes back to me and says like, oh, you might have this condition that is, you know, like sometimes it's benign and sometimes it's not, but we can treat it with we can treat it and see like what's going on. And I remember thinking at that point, like, actually, I was like, I want to explore this not being benign at all. And from all of my reading, I was like, the worst case scenario of what this can be is a kind of cancer. Like, it's a kind of cancer. And the way to find that out is to get an MRI. And so at this point, I have not, you know, I am very much like, I was like, I know my body, and I have reached the end of my rope. This doctor is being like very kind and compassionate, and she's doing everything that is within her power to do. But I'm also like, I'm 33 and I've been going through this for years.
I want
like,
this
it
to
has
end.
Been, it has been 20 years of this. And so as I'm talking, you know, like I have this procedure where basically she inserts an IUD because she wants me to be like mainlining the hormones from there. It's also a form of contraception. It was great. And we had discussed that when she put in the IUD while I was under, she would also put a camera up my vagina to see what was really going on in there. And this whole procedure is supposed to take like about 30 minutes. And when I come to, and the reason that I had to have an IUD put under is that I am I'm a sexual assault survivor, and I never do well with the pelvic exam. And so one way that my doctor was like super compassionate and awesome, she was like, okay, great. I'm going to do this really invasive procedure on you, and your insurance will cover it if we just like, she's like, let's knock you out. And then we don't have to have the tenseness of the like doing it while you're
do they use I just looked it up. It's a colposcopy. Thank you. Colposcopy. Mm-hmm. Is that usually done while you're awake? Typically?
No. So the colposcopy is done when you're under. But so this was the deal. It was like she was gonna put the IUD in, and then I'm already under, so let's do the colposcopy and find out.
Got you. Okay.
And when I come to from the IUD insertion, all I care about is I was like, hey, what did the colposcopy show? And she tells me that she did not do the colposcopy because of my my cervix was like just dilated in a way where she was like, if I did it, your body would reject the IUD. So she was like, let's schedule it for another day. Which was like a totally plausible, like, you know, I was like, you're the doctor, great explanation. Mm-hmm. And just for me, did not sit well. Whatever last resort of like gut instinct I have was like, oh no, this was my one chance of finding out like what was wrong inside my body. And she didn't do it for like a very good reason and a very like plausible reason. She was like, we'll do it another day. But for me, I just felt in my gut, I was like, no, I was like, this is the, you know, like we made a deal before I went under, and then the plan changed. And it's not that I don't trust her. I, you know, her explanation was totally plausible, but for me, it was just this, it didn't feel right. I was like, actually, I care less about the IUD and I care more about the, like, can you just look and see? Because at this point, I'm convinced that there is something very wrong with me.
Yeah, and you were, like, so, this close to getting that answer in your mind.
Right.
So, like, I could understand why you'd feel that way.
Right. And so, you know, and she's, like, giving me drugs to, like, to treat this thing. And it's mostly, like, more hormones. And then my body ends up rejecting the IUD anyway. I was making a sandwich and my IUD was like on the, I was like poo bearing it in my house, just wearing a t-shirt and making a sandwich. And there's this, I love telling the story on your podcast and grossing everyone out, but it was amazing. And there was legit an IUD on the ground. I was like, what is this string of, it was so nuts. Y'all, it was so nuts.
God, what does an IUD look like? I don't know if I
remember. It's so small. It's like a little copper, exactly. The copper one is the old school one. The one that has hormones on it is like a tiny bit of plastic.
It's like a fish hook.
I like how you said you were.
It's kind of similar to the shape of a uterus, right? Like it's got like that sort of like.
Yeah.
I really like you described yourself.
Just saying.
As poo-bearing.
Poo-bearing it. Oh, yeah, that was so hilarious. Good. That's my new thing. Like, I'm going to poo-bear it all the time around my house.
Listen, when you're at home, sometimes you poo-bear it. You're like, you're wearing a t-shirt, no underwear. It happens.
Sick Boy Podcast will be right back after this very short break.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
But anyway, my body ends up rejecting this IUD, which to me is another sign of like, okay, my body has fully rejected Western medicine, so let's talk about it. And at this point, the next recourse is this MRI. An MRI is awful. If you've never had an MRI and no one has told you, it is a terrible,
it's like, terrifying, right?
I was so not prepared for the noise. No one had told me. It's like a Stanley Kubrick movie in there. It's awful. Right, and it like lasts forever. It was like 90 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And I was so lucky that I didn't have to have my full body in because it's obviously my pelvis. But I was like, if I had to go in here with my head, I would be screaming. Like, there was just no way.
Oh, that's wild. I had one on my pelvis and I was full body. But mine wasn't, I had one last year. I broke my pelvis. But it wasn't 90 minutes. God damn. Mine was
90 minutes.
I was probably 10, 15, maybe 20 minutes, but fuck, 90 minutes.
I remember Todd Taylor telling us about the sound, though, and it sounded so
And it's like a different pattern of noise every time they do the imaging, and it's so loud, and they're like, don't move! Stop moving!
Total alien noises. But anyway, I promise I'm going to wrap the story up. But anyway, long story short, the technician was like, when I went in, was like, oh, your doctor will call you next week. And as I was leaving, he's like, your doctor will call you. And I was like, okay. Like, you know, I was like, you're seeing me. I am seeing you. Yeah. And and I got called into the hospital literally the next day. And it was really funny because I don't think that the doctor she did not use the words cancer. She just kept talking about a tumor. She was like, there's a tumor and she's showing me where it is or whatever. And I'm like, lady, I'm a civilian. Like, Just tell me what this is. And she's like, well, there's a tumor. And I was like, is it cancer? And finally she says, well, yes, evidence of a tumor. Like, you know, she's still using all the medical lingo.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm a Grey's Anatomy doctor, so just give it to me straight.
I know, me too, totally.
Brian actually is. Shit. Yeah, Brian, you do love that.
but we've heard that a number of times and where people say that, like, the doctors or medical professionals won't say cancer. They just... say tumor, benign, malignant, or whatever it is. But to me, like, I would want to know that. I would want to hear, just tell me it's cancer. If it's cancer, just tell me it's cancer. Because again, like, that goes back to the process and like feeling like once you have that diagnosis, we can attach, we have some type of like understanding of what it means to be diagnosed with cancer. So in terms of like the mental health side of it, like grieving that diagnosis, it just helps to, I would imagine that it would help to hear it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I've never had to give anyone that kind of bad news. And so I guess I have compassion for doctors who have to constantly just tell people bad news. And I do think that, you know, a way of protecting their own mental health is couching it in a lot of just this like medical jargon because, you know, because the next thing is everyone is like, how long am I going to live? What's going to happen? And I was like, well, you know, I'm not equipped for that. And no shade to doctors, but, you know, they are generally not emotionally equipped for the other side of the job that they have to do also.
Yeah.
So,
I think that there's something in there where a doctor is most likely trained or to give news in this way mm-hmm. probably something that's relatively standard, and the shortfall is that everybody is different. So in the way that we're sitting around, and I think if I if, you know, gun to my head, I think I agree with you. I'd like to hear cancer, because then it really does it, like, I would feel like, just tell me. And then there's other people that would be like, holy shit, yeah, don't say cancer. Like, yeah, like I'm going to die tomorrow now. Where the reality might be like, it's a tumor, and like, we feel confident we can, you know, shoot it with radiation and shrink it. And
right. But also, to be fair to the doctors, part of not telling you is that all they do know is that it's a tumor. And in order to even tell you what's up with the tumor, they have to remove it.
Yeah.
They have to remove it to do a pathology. And so you have to be able to, you know, because they tell you, they're like, we think it's stage 1, 2, 3, 4. But truly, like, they don't know until they, like, remove it from your body. And then they look at it, and then they can tell you exactly what's going on.
Right. Because they can't even really tell you that it's, can they tell you that it's cancerous before they do a biopsy on it?
I don't think so.
I think they have to take it out and then say malignant or
at Seattle Grace, at least. At Seattle Grace, the hospital that Brian and I trained at.
Oh, man, that went over my head for a sec, but now I hear it. I got you.
The Grey's Anatomy. The Grey's Anatomy.
I was like, you went to Seattle. Okay,
Seattle Grace. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Seattle Grace. That sounds real for sure.
Yeah, you know, I think that all of it is really fraught, because so much of your personality depends, like whatever happened depends. I will say that my doctor, she asked me if she could give me a hug, and it was such a human moment
really
because
sweet.
I could tell that it was really, it looked like it was harder for her than it was for me. I was giddy. I was just like, oh my God, cancer, I could work with that, you know, but I can't work with not knowing what is happening. Yeah. And it wasn't until I left that I got this like sense of like being really, I went, she made me talk to the hospital social worker who was, you know, I'm not saying that this is the case for everyone, but my hospital social worker was definitely a trainee and did, you know, like was not equipped for the energy that I was bringing to my diagnosis. So we were very mismatched.
Right.
Yeah.
And that ended very badly. They were like, do you want to come back next week? And I was like, absolutely never again. Mm. Like, I have better coping skills than this person. But yeah, I just, for me, it felt like really freeing. And actually it was it started me on this journey of really being like, okay, what are the things that matter to me and not? And, you know, and I've always been someone who my entire life, I'm convinced that I'm going to die very young. My mom died like when she was very young. And so I'm obsessed with dying. Mm. And so that was not, it didn't scare me the way that, you know, it would have if I'm not someone who is, it's anytime I do anything, I'm like, oh, I'm going to die today. Like, probably should make my bed. Mm. Probably should wear my nice underwear. Probably should, like, I was like, I'm going to die today. And so it wasn't that big of a shock, but it was, you know, it was definitely a journey, and it was really hard. Mm. And, you know, and I think telling people I had cancer was much harder than hearing it. Yeah. I had cancer.
That's what I was curious about. Especially, you know, like talking about at the beginning, talking about how you host this podcast with your best friend. In terms of the conversation that you had with Anne offline, like, what was it like when you first told her or any of your other close friends? Like, how did you go about doing that?
So there was a small group of friends that I had been keeping appraised in the like months leading up to this. Like, I was like, here's what today's test showed, and this is the thing. So I kind of had an inkling that I would start having to disclose this stuff. So I think there was like a group of like 8 people who were my kind of like my closest friends and support, where and a lot of them live not in New York, where I really needed to keep them up to date. And I think the way I remember it, at least, is that like when the day I found out, I instead of taking the train home, I took this really long walk because the hospital is like way uptown in Manhattan. And I took this really long walk to downtown, and I just listened to music and just like try to figure out like, okay, how am I going to tell everyone I need to tell? And what is the best way to just tell everyone at the same time? Because I am so exhausted by this. Mm-hmm. And so I remember calling Anne on that walk and just letting her know, you know, like I was like, here is what the diagnosis is. I'm sure she was super compassionate and clear, whatever. I truly do not remember it. I then sent out an email to the group of friends. You know, some of them tried calling me immediately, and I was like, sorry, I'm on this really delightful walk. Can't really talk to you right now. And then, you know, and then I like made an Instagram post because I was just, I hate having to repeat myself. It's my number one pet peeve in life is just having to deliver the same information to people. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's a grocery order or it's a, you know, like, hi, my life is severely impacted by a medical diagnosis.
God, you must have hated promoting your book.
Oh, I hate it. I hate it. I hate all of this. Yeah. And so I remember making this Instagram post because I was really focused on like, okay, what is every cliche I know about cancer and about illness? And also like, just I like boundaries are really important to me. And I think that you have to state your boundaries really clearly with people if you expect them to know how to deal with you. And so I should probably go back and read that post. But I think the gist of it was I have cancer. I really don't want to make it about me because actually this cancer is super prevalent. Like that was what was so shocking to me. Once I started reading about it, I was like, oh, like hundreds of thousands of people have this cancer around the world. And I am just hearing about it for the first time. So I should probably learn more. And I was also just trying to find a way to deflect from myself. And so I was like, okay, like read about endometrial cancer. Please sign up for healthcare. It was in December, and so our like healthcare enrollment period was starting, and I almost didn't sign up for healthcare that year because I was like, I'm young and healthy, I don't need this, and if I hadn't, my life would be bankrupt today, and I did it on a fluke, and so I encourage everyone to sign up for healthcare, and I also told everyone that I was like, if you want to pray for me, go ahead and do it. But like, I don't want to hear anything about alternative medicine to cancer. Like that was my big boundary. I was like, I am giving my body to Western medicine. I'm going to do all the things that my doctor says. I do not want to hear about a potion or a drink or I'm going to trust the lasers. Yeah. This is what I'm doing. I want Chernobyl in my body. And that I think was the hardest boundary to enforce, like all in all, is that so many people have, you know, I understand why everyone has, you know, like everyone has their own experience with cancer and they have their own experience with whatever. Even in the cancer support group that I was in, a lot of people were very distrustful of Western medicine. And for me, I was like, I am the opposite. I was like, Western medicine's not great, but it's what I'm putting my trust and my faith in and respect my choices.
Did you feel it? Did you, on that note of the note of the support group, did you feel like you were brought in to any sense of community when you got your diagnosis? Did you feel like you were with people? Or was that something that didn't really resonate with you?
You know, in the beginning, it didn't resonate with me because I have such a strong friend support system already where I was like, why do I need to be friends with people who have cancer? Like, it just didn't make sense to me. I was like, I feel so supported in my regular life. And I do think now looking back on it, a lot of that also was like it was denialism. Yeah. Like I was like, that was a way of protecting myself where, you know, if I'm the only person that I know is sick, then, you know, I'm like, I can roll with that. But I think that seeing sickness all of the time is something that would be really rough. And so the first really treatment for endometrial cancer is that you have to have a hysterectomy. And so the first online support group that I joined is this community called Hyster Sisters that has been around forever and is low-key actually great because it's just like email, you know, like they're forums and things like that if you want to be inside of them. I was not in the forums. I was like, I just want the emails and I want some of this stuff. And then as the weeks progressed, you know, people started telling me about like Facebook groups for people who had had hysterectomies because not everyone who has the hysterectomies has them for cancer reasons. Yeah. So Facebook actually is a great place for this kind of stuff where you're like, I don't know anyone. Like, look up a group for anything and it exists. And so it's the only thing that I would ever recommend Facebook for is the group function. And so I joined a couple of groups that were like people who had my specific kind of cancer. And some of them were like, we were diagnosed in the same month. So we got to follow each other.
Oh, wow.
And I also joined a group for people who had had like just hysterectomies because you should know. And I ended up joining an in-person support group. Which was really, you know, I was so resistant to doing it. And those women are now some of my favorite people in the entire world because we, you know, we like went through some shit together and it was really nice.
What was the part of it that made it worth it in the end? Was it strictly because of the fact that if you hadn't gone and done that, there would have been more isolation or feelings of like aloneness, or is it just because you just can't help but find healing within having close and meaningful contact with other people who have been through the same experience as you? Like, what, like, is that, you know, like, I get the idea of being resistant to it, because I've always been resistant to like online cystic fibrosis support groups, because I've just been like, it just seems like a pity party. Or at least yeah. that's what
and you've got the friend, and you've got the friends, and I have the friend group. Like, you've got that good support
right.
system.
You already have a good support
but,
system.
But then it wasn't until after we started the podcast that I started to realize how rich it can be to have conversations with other people who have gone through the same experience as me, you know? And like, yeah. and so, yeah.
There's something in both sides, I think, you know, like there's in the, you know, if you've got no sort of built-in support system, then those communities are going to probably do a lot for you, because they're going to make you feel like you're heard. They're going to make you feel like you're not alone. And even if you do have that built-in support system, you're lucky enough to have that support system where you feel like you can have those conversations with the people around you, which like a lot of people don't. And a lot of people, it pushes people away from them, unfortunately, which really sucks. And I mean, obviously that's a big part of the podcast and what we're trying to do. But you know, if that is the case, then, you know, or if you do have that support group with friends and family, at the end of the day, they're not going as great as they might be and as supportive as they might be. They might not get it all, because, you know, Jer, like for you and me, for example, like, I don't know what it's like to take all the pills that you do. And I don't know what it's like to wake up and do the mask every morning and the coughing and all the stuff that comes.
There's
with
a limit
it, you
know? To your love.
There's a limit to your love.
Wow. How are you going to clear that sample? You know, I think that, you know, all of that is really true. I was, and we write about this in our book, because we write about illness between, you know, being a point of stretching between me and Anne, because she is the most like understanding and super flexible, you know, like really rolled with the punches of me being sick. But it was also a stretch in our relationship, because there was so much that she just, you know, for her, like, couldn't be there for, and also couldn't understand. And, you know, also, like, she lives far away. Mm-hmm. But I will say that, like, my friends are iconic and amazing. Like, I, for someone who was, like, living alone and single, a huge experience of my hysterectomy and later cancer treatment was that I would go to these support groups where most of the women were married with kids. And I always felt like I was the most supported person in the room. I was like, my friends have made sure that my house is clean. There is food in my fridge. I want for nothing. Like the logistics of it, like, I'm friends with the most like Capricorns, and the spreadsheets were great. Like, I just never a moment where a thing was dropped. I do think that like part of like joining the support groups for me, and specifically the in-person one, was not, it was where a place where I had to stretch myself emotionally, because I think that it's, you know, for as much as we're all like gregarious, whatever, adults or whatever, there's not a world in which I would have ever met these people if it hadn't been through the support group. And now they are such a rich part of the texture of my life. And I do think that there was something about submitting to like, sure, like I'm young and I think I'm cool and I'm whatever, but I was really inflexible in how people were coming into my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that so much of what the support group brought to me was really this understanding of like, okay, even if I refuse to like commune with people who have a gynecological cancer, I am in community with them. You know, like whether I tell myself that or not, I was like, I'm part of this community. And I don't know, like, I've had so many, like, beautiful friendships that have come out of that. And with women who are so much older than me, you know, like, they're all these, like, older, like, badass New York City broads. And I would have never met them. I would have never met them, and I cannot imagine my life now without the women in that group. Like, we're in a walking group together, and it's so fun, and COVID has been, like, awful because we've just been so super isolated from each other, but we're finding ways to connect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that for me it was also, like, a really humbling experience of I am someone who I think of myself as someone who is really strong and I don't need anything. And, you know, and that's like partially true, but also I don't need anything because the people in my life love me so much that they make me feel like I don't need anything. Mm. But I do think that it is really important to open yourself up to having a different kind of experience and to meeting people that you share something in common with, especially if it's illness. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that you're going to be best friends with, you know, a lot of those people. Like sometimes
there's
like
still
the women
at the
hospital. Yeah, there's still people at the end of the day. Sometimes the women at the hospital will say things that I'm like, "You're voting for who?
Yeah.
You're what?" You know, and I'm like, "Excuse me?" Like, I was like, "No, like you cannot be a meaningful part of my life." But there was really something about like just it was really humbling for me. It was really really humbling, and I think also it reminds me that like I am not very good at being gentle with myself, and I think that so much of avoiding the support system of the hospital is that, you know, I think that it feels indulgent because at the end of the day, I was like, sure, I had this cancer experience, but everything went relatively easy for me, you know, which is such a demented thing to think about, like dealing with illness. But I'm just like, yeah, I was like, my operation went well and I had like few complications and then my recovery was fine. And then the radiation went well, you know, it's just this refusing to understand that I went through something really traumatic. And I think that just being around other people who are experiencing the same thing as I am, you know, whether it's like, oh yeah, your bladder is doing that weird thing too, like you're having all of these weird side effects, is such a reminder of the fact that like, yeah, we did go through something like really hard and traumatic together.
You're bound to take something from that. So I'm going to ask you a question then that we typically ask most of our guests. And
Jared, before you ask that question, that's the last one before we get into wrapping up, I did want to ask one more question about the hysterectomy. Because when you have a hysterectomy, does that set your body into early onset menopause or menopause. Or trigger early? Is it, what is it called?
Early menopause, or I believe menopause. They call it medical menopause. Mm-hmm. But okay. So what triggers menopause is not making hormones, which is like that's tied to your ovaries. So I had a total hysterectomy, which means that my uterus is gone, my ovaries are gone, my fallopian tubes are gone, and I want to say like the top part of my vagina maybe. Like it was like a radical hysterectomy. And so the minute that your ovaries are gone, you are in full medical menopause. And that shit hits you like a ton of bricks. And so in some ways, I always joke that I was like, you know, cancer was easier than menopause. Honestly, menopause has been like a completely different beast. And that's like just another part of life that women don't talk about. I'm like, I'm a legit like old school, been calling myself a feminist since I was young. I've like read, you know, I've read all the books, like Our Bodies, Ourselves. I've done the vagina monologues, all of them. And menopause has been a shock to my system. Mm-hmm. And that is a whole, you know, like that's a whole other conversation about just like the ways that in women, we prize fertility as like this, you know, it's a sign of youth and like being vivacious or whatever. And I was like, I lost my uterus when I was 33. Does it mean that I am no longer young and, you know, and like a contributing member of society?
Did it affect your feelings towards like your own identity as a female?
No, because I think that I have understood from a really long time that your, you know, the biological parts of your body are not what make you a woman at all, and what make me. I think that a thing that I was really unprepared for, though, and it's something that I've had like a complicated relationship with, is that I think that if you had asked me when I was having a hysterectomy, like my doctors were all very much like, you should freeze your eggs.
Right.
Because like you should freeze your eggs. And I ended up not freezing my eggs for many reasons. One of them being that it would have delayed my treatment. One of them being that I didn't want more hormones in my body. And also because of the cost associated with all of it. I was like, well, if I don't have a uterus, I have to get a surrogate. Like, you know, I was like, I made someone like do the math of it. I was like, if everything goes right, like everything goes right, and my friend who's a lawyer does the paperwork, how much will this cost? And it was north of $100,000. And I made a decision for myself that, you know, and I asked myself, I was like, if I had $100,000 in the bank tomorrow, what am I going to do? Am I going to buy a baby or am I going to, you know,
get a
like,
Ferrari?
Some shoes. Yeah. You know, like, and I was like, I am not buying a $100,000 baby. And I remember the fertility doctor at the time telling me that it was a big mistake, and I got really upset. Like, I got really, really upset. And I believe that he should have phrased that differently.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
Now with the hindsight of a couple of years, I wish I had done it because it's just an option. Yeah. You know, like, I don't think that it's an option I would exercise still. Like, I don't think that I would, like, rush out and, you know, unfreeze the eggs and, like, find $100,000 to make that happen.
But it's there.
But I think that, like, as you get better, you know, as you get better and you look back on your life, you start, you know, like, you kind of retcon the whole thing. And it's like, well, I didn't give myself a chance at having, you know, like, biological children, which is not the only way to have a family, BTW. Mm-hmm. But I have been really surprised at how painful that has been. It's also true that it's gotten a lot better. My first year out of surgery, I had a full meltdown over it. I was like, I cannot believe I did this, whatever. And all of it is so unknowable, right? It's like I could have frozen my eggs and still, you know, they would have never amounted to like viable human beings. But like all of it is so unknowable. But I do think that giving yourself some options, because I realize that that's actually what I'm mad about. I'm not mad about the fact that I'm not going to have my own biological kids. I'm mad about the fact that I don't have the option to.
Yeah,
and that is the, you know, that's the thing that I'm working through. But I'm proud to say that every year it's gotten a little bit easier. You know, like I do think I talk to a lot of people who, for various reasons, have not been able to have children, and or to like carry their own biological children. And a thing that I, like, everyone has said that has been, like, a real comfort to me is that they're like, yeah, they're like, a year comes where you just accept it and it's just not a big deal anymore. And you're just like, yeah. And I already know this. I was like, having your own kids is not the only way to have a family. I was like, and that was the calculus that I made when I decided not to freeze my eggs. I was like, I'm not going to spend $100,000 on, you know, this fake idea of family when I could adopt kids or I could end up with a partner that already has kids, or, you know, or maybe I also just want to be child free. Like, all of those are amazing ways to be. Mm-hmm. And so I've been surprised at like my feelings around that. I'm definitely working through them. I think, yeah, it's getting easier. It's getting better. But the whole thing is kind of a crapshoot. It sucks.
Yeah.
I apologize, Jared, because I actually do have one more.
Wow,
one more,
all these
one
apologies.
More
you guys just apologize to each
I'm
other.
So sorry.
I love
I'm so
this.
Sorry. I'm sorry. So sorry about that.
Sorry,
I wanted to highlight before we do wrap up that you said something, well, now maybe about 10 minutes ago, that I think when you said that you had the hysterectomy, I kind of thought, and going back to kind of the beginning of our conversation, we were talking about like the way that we talk about the human body and the way that there's taboo surrounding talking about this stuff, and it starts from an early age and it gets baked in and it's in our society, it's in our family, it's in our friends. And I'm not a person that likes to look back and go, what if? I'm just not. That's just not, you know, march forward and do with what you've got. But maybe going back, if the narrative is different from the beginning, not that you don't still end up without your uterus and without your ovaries and everything, but like, I don't know. If the conversation's different from the beginning, does the chain of events ultimately change for somebody out there who feels more comfortable having those conversations earlier, having those conversations with different people, and they're more accepted and they're more, and you're more like, yeah, you should get that checked out or whatever. And then you end up getting maybe earlier care or better care for whatever reason, because just from the outset, the taboo nature around the subjects isn't there. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had that thought, not saying that, like, you know, if it was just that little shade different in the way that we talk about it, that, you know, you don't end up with, you don't end up with endometrial cancer. But, you know, I don't know. I just think about that.
Like, if there's an open conversation around this stuff, does it help us catch things earlier?
Yeah, right. Does it change
it
in a way?
I think
yeah.
it absolutely does. I think that I can only speak to my own experience, but I know, like, talking to my friends who are women, I understand that there is just an amount of pain that every woman just lives with that is, like, honestly, like, at this point, I'm like, it's ridiculous. When I was growing up, whenever my dad had a cold, our entire household would, like, grind to a halt. It's just like, my dad has a cold, you know, like, everyone is deputized in Médecins Sans Frontières now. We are all, you know, like, we're all doing the things. Like, we are tending God. To him. And there is a way that we are all, you know, like, we're all very dismissive of man flu. Like, I always, you know, I, like, yeah. even with my adult women friends who, like, date men or whatever, anytime a man we know is sick, we're always like, ugh, like, man flu, and we're always making fun of them. And I was like, actually, I am reframing this conversation to say that, like, a thing that men do that I find admirable is stretching it, but I think a thing that I would like to adopt for myself is that there is a full and total refusal to be uncomfortable in your body when you don't feel good, whether, you know, it's like a common cold or you actually have, you know, something more severe.
That I shut it down completely.
Yeah, shut down completely. But now, you know, I wish that, like, that was something that had been ingrained in me as a child. And I was like, instead of just enduring pain as something that is admirable, I would say, like, hey, actually, this doesn't feel good. This just doesn't feel good. And it is something that I will keep pushing towards investigating and figuring out. Because for me, it took a really long time. And, you know, and I'm with you. I don't do the what if. Like, there's no what if in which, like, I still don't have cancer. And to be really clear, not having a uterus is the best fucking thing that's ever happened to me. I love it. I'm like, would not trade this back. This lifestyle is lit. love it. And so, you know, so I'm not, like, super sad about that. But I do think that it's like not taking pain as something that you have to endure.
Yeah.
And it's like, you should ask questions and you should push. And also, you should be skeptical of your doctors, not in the sense that you should be combative with your doctors and not trust them. But at the end of the day, your body is your own equipment. And, you know, and a doctor is, you know, not to be like a crass American about the whole thing, but maybe in our healthcare system, this is helpful. You know, at the end of the day, I was like, it is still a business and you get what you pay for and you still have to be involved in your own care. And I know that I have such a deference to, like, people who are experts, whether they're doctors or they're lawyers or they're whatever, because they have degrees that I don't have and they know things that, you know, I don't know. But I do think that a really basic understanding of how, you know, like, the systems that just keep you alive is what is going to keep keeping you alive. And so I think that it's why I was really excited to talk to you all, because I think that these are, you know, there's a world in which people are like, oh, these are just, like, really self-indulgent, like, fun conversations or whatever. But at the end of the day, I was like, this is literally how friends save each other's lives all the time. It's like dumb conversations about, like, what your poop looks like, or, like, how you're peeing, or, like, what do you mean your dick hurts when you try to masturbate? You know, like this is the stuff that actually makes a difference with people. Like, you know, I'm like, maybe a PSA is helpful, but I do think that among friends and, you know, like, among the people who, like, care about you and think about you and listen to you, this is the stuff that really, really, really resonates. And it is lifting a stigma and it's lifting shame. And, you know, and all of it is just, when you think about it, it's so silly that we have decided that we
get so weird about it.
Rubric of things that we can talk about. And then there's other, you know, I'm just like, we're alive and we're here. I don't care if there are weird things that happen in our body. I'm just so glad that we can all be together to talk about them. So,
Aminachi, what would you say is the biggest thing that your experience with endometrial cancer has taken away from you?
That's a tough question. I think, you know, like, the thing with kids, like, probably, like, the experience of, like, could I ever have my own children? But I don't have, like, big regrets about it. So truly, I think, not to be like cancer is so cliche. People are, it's like why all the cancer memoirs are so cliche and bad, because you're just like, I've seen the light and now I just, you know, like, my life is rich and amazing. But I will say that I feel incredibly lucky that at a young enough age, I understand just how, like, precious and precarious life is, you know? And I think that that has, I keep focusing on actually, like, what having cancer had, like, gave me. Not that I wish it on anyone or that I think that there's anything admirable about being sick. I was like, being sick is being sick and it fucking sucks. But I do think that, like, my life is forever changed in the sense that, like, I know exactly who in my life matters to me. I know what things matter to me. Like, you know, there were people in my life that I expected to be there when I was sick who were nowhere to be found, and it didn't hurt as much as I thought it would. And then there were people that I realized had been there all along who I had never been paying attention to, you know, who, like, stepped up and were amazing friends to me. And that has been, like, how often in life do you get an experience that just clarifies everything for you?
What a gift.
You know, you're just like, great. You're like, wow, like the here is the deck. And I think that for me, that was like a really transformative experience. And truly, you know, it's also just like, okay, like that's not the hardest thing I've done in life. It's probably not going to be the hardest thing I'm going to do even this decade. And I'm glad that, you know, for it's been helpful for other people in my life. Anne ended up planning this, like, series of blood drives because that was one of my stipulations when I told everyone I had cancer. I was like, please don't text me. Just, like, do blood drives.
Right, sure, yeah, yeah.
Because my therapist was like, if people are driving you crazy, you have to give them something to do. And I was like, great, this is a thing you can works. Do. Like, don't text me. I'm watching Housewives. Like, do other things. And it was really funny that through the experience of the blood drive, I now know all of my friends' weird illnesses because people thought the blood was for me. And they're like, I mean, I'm so sorry. I can't give blood. I've, like, slept with men before and, like, they won't let me donate, or I have malaria, or I have this weird condition. And
I've,
like,
slept with
it
men
was
before.
So hilarious. I mean, yeah, the blood donation requirements in America are so homophobic and awful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
like,
yeah.
Just the whole thing is just, yeah, like, talk about another
that's,
scam.
That's
like,
a whole
it's
other
so
fucking
awful.
Can of worms.
But it was just, like, that to me was, like, a really, it's, like, one of the most, like, delightful things that happened is that now, like, truly I know what all of my friends, like, you know, I'm just like, what? I'm like, you had hepatitis when? You know, like, all of these things. And for me, it just, like, opened up a really fun line of communication. And, like, I was like, great. I was like, now we have no shame. I was like, you, like, literally know everything about the inside of my vagina and my uterus. And I know something about your medical condition. And we still love each other. And it's fine.
Absolutely. Call Your Girlfriend podcast. People can check it out, I guess, wherever you get your podcasts. We didn't really go into it, but we did, like, kind of talk about it here and there. But Big Friendship, How We Keep Each Other Close, that is the book that you have co-authored with Anne, your co-host of the podcast as well. Where can people keep up with you, follow you, keep up to date with all the cool shit that you're up to?
You can find me at bigfriendship.com, where all things Big Friendship live, or at callyourgirlfriend.com, where all things Call Your Girlfriends live.
Sweet. Thank you so much for taking the time today to shoot the shit with us and to give us a little peek into your experience, with cancer. I think, you know, it's like we covered a lot of shit today, but I feel like there's a lot of it that's definitely going to, like, resonate with a lot of our listeners, especially a lot of our listeners who have vaginas and who have also gone through similar experiences to yourself. So thanks for taking the time.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun. Canadian people, who knew? Just delightful, delightful. Everything they say about your people. That's true. I really appreciate you all making the time. This was really
cool.
Great.
Thank you all so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. As always, we'll be back next week with another episode, another conversation. In the meantime, go to Apple Podcasts, leave a rating or review, hit the subscribe button, all that stuff. Go to Spotify. And you can follow us there. And if you want to support the podcast in greater ways, you can do that. You're welcome to.
Head right on over to patreon.com/sickboy. Patreon is just totally popping off. We're having Wednesday night hangouts every Wednesday night. There's you're getting free access to our digital
You'll
shows.
You'll literally drown in shit to do over there.
You're going to have so much shit to do. If you're stuck inside somewhere, you're going to be you're going to be aching for less to do if you're a patron of Sick Boy. patreon.com/sickboy.
And thanks as always to Donovan, the CPAP Morgan, for the amazing sound design on the show. Donovan, you know what? I've been thinking a lot about listening to Call Your Girlfriend podcast, and you know, it's been making me think a lot about like sitting in my laundry room as like a 12-year-old guy, sitting there with a rotary phone, dialing up my friends and like having these like long, thoughtful conversations into the evening, even as a 12-year-old boy. So
did you and I have long, thoughtful conversations?
I think
in your
so.
Laundry room when we were 12.
So. Or calling, at least calling people that I wanted so to, cute. You know, that I was romantically crushing on at
yeah,
the time.
Yeah,
that sounds
boring.
So Donovan, thanks for making it sound like I'm dialing that rotary phone and those phones are just ringing off the hook right now. That's
great.
All I got, guys.
That is it for this week.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy. Amazing. Sweet.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.